Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the program, we'll be reviewing our current efforts to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. And our guest is Matthew Bunn. He is a senior research associate in the Project on Managing the Atom in the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. His research interests include nuclear theft and terrorism, nuclear proliferation, and measures to control it. Before joining the Kennedy School, he served for 3 years as an advisor to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, where he played a major role in U.S. policies related to the control and disposition of weapons-usable nuclear materials in the U.S. and the former Soviet Union. He also directed a study, a secret study, in fact, for President Clinton on security for nuclear material in Russia. He's authored a number of books and technical reports dealing with these subjects. He holds a doctorate in technology management and policy from MIT, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. We just ask people who call in with questions to be brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, callers are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good for any one, if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois or Indiana. In fact, even people listening on the Internet, as long as they're in the United States, may use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana again, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Bunn, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Just to review right here at the beginning, we know that there are a number of countries in the world that have demonstrated the capability to build a nuclear weapon and have some numbers of them. And there are some, like the United States on one end, the United States and Russia, with significant numbers. And there are others where the numbers are smaller. But if we just ask this question, how many nations and what are they in the world today that possess nuclear weapons? What's the answer?
There are 9 states today with nuclear weapons. And remarkably, if you ask 20 years ago, there were 9 states with nuclear weapons. South Africa, during those 20 years, became the first ever case of real nuclear disarmament, taking apart 6 nuclear weapons that it had built. And North Korea added itself to the list with its nuclear test last year. But to have no net increase in the number of nuclear weapon states over a 20-year period that included secret nuclear weapons programs in Iraq, Iran, Libya, North Korea, the chaos following the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think is actually a fairly impressive record of success. The 9 states with nuclear weapons are the 5 permanent members of the Security Council, that is the United States, Russia, Britain, France, and China, plus India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea.
The fact that this list has been relatively stable and that in recent years the only additions have been most recently, North Korea, and then before that, at about the same time, India and Pakistan conducted tests.
Well, India and Pakistan had both had nuclear weapons for many years prior to that. Their tests were essentially a public announcement of capability that everybody knew they had already.
All right. So that, and also if you add to that the fact, as you say, of the South African case, perhaps also add to that to the fact that there had been other countries that had some kind of research program,
yes,
that also then closed the program down.
Yes.
I think some people would say that means that the international regimes that we have to try to limit the spread of nuclear weapons, at least as far as states go, as far as trying to discourage nations from developing programs, they might well say that the effort actually has been successful, and would want to say yes, in fact, it has worked. And if it hadn't, we probably would have more nuclear weapons out there than we do.
I think these efforts have been a remarkable success. President Kennedy, when he was president, predicted that by the late 1970s we might have 25 to 30 nuclear armed states, and that didn't happen. And one of the reasons it didn't happen is that the countries around the world join together in a global effort to stem the spread of nuclear weapons. Now, that's not to say we haven't got any problems. We've got a lot of problems, and their major work needs to be done now to fix up this global regime to stem the spread of nuclear weapons. We have in the black market network led by Pakistan's AQ Khan, one of the worst proliferation disasters of the nuclear age, and that they were marketing the essential technology for the determined nuclear cheater, that is the uranium enrichment centrifuge, to hostile regimes all over the world. We need to do more on stronger inspections, tougher enforcement, better security for stockpiles so that they can't be stolen and fall into the hands of terrorists. But there are opportunities to do more on all of those things, and I think if we do more and at the same time ratchet back the size and importance of our own nuclear stockpile, which is a key part of the nonproliferation bargain, we have at least a shot at having 20 years from now still only 9 states with nuclear weapons and maybe even fewer. That should certainly be our goal.
There is now concern, certainly there is concern here on the part of the United States government about Iran. And the U.S. government maintains that Iran is interested in developing nuclear weapons. The government of Iran, I think that's at least to date their official public position has been to say, no, we're interested in the peaceful development of nuclear power to generate energy, but we are not interested in developing nuclear weapons. So here, this for some time now, this has been a main source of tension, at least between the governments of Iran and the United States. Is there some? What can one say with assurance, or can one say much with assurance about Iran and its nuclear ambitions, if indeed it has any?
Well, Iran is clearly developing technology that would allow it, at very short notice, to begin production of nuclear bomb material. The centrifuges that they are developing and deploying can be used to make low-enriched uranium for nuclear power plant fuel, but they can be switched very quickly to making highly enriched uranium for nuclear bombs. And that is why Iran's program has been such a concern, combined with the fact that they kept that program secret and violated their safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency for 18 years. They are now in talks with the IAEA about trying to clear up what remains of their past violations and the remaining uncertainties about what they did during the secret part of their program. But even if they manage to clear up all those uncertainties, the mere technical fact of having in place technology that would allow them to rapidly make nuclear bomb material worries many people, including me.
Mm-hmm. I'm certain that there are other nations that would have sufficient level of technology so that if they chose to, it would be technically possible for them to develop weapons. And there, I think there is particular concern about perhaps some. Now, one of the declared states obviously is China, but I think that there is some concern perhaps about other states in Asia that might take this route. In addition to this concern about Iran, is there any other nation where we have reason to believe that they might actually have been at least thinking about the possibility of developing a weapons program?
Well, many states have considered developing nuclear weapons and have, in fact, launched nuclear weapons programs over the years. One of the things that most people don't realize is that efforts to stop states from getting nuclear weapons succeed more often than they fail. There are now more states in the world that started nuclear weapons programs and verifiably agreed to give them up than there are states with nuclear weapons. So that is another indicator of the success of the global efforts. But nonetheless, we have to remember that the states we're worried about today are quite different than the states we were worried about 30 years ago, and one has to expect that 30 years or even 10 years in the future, there may be additional states that you have to worry about that we aren't so worried about today. There's one very important recent article that had the jocular title, Never Say Never Again, that was about states that started nuclear weapons programs in the past and gave them up, but might be tempted to return to them in the future if circumstances changed. For example, if North Korea became a robust nuclear weapons state with a big nuclear arsenal, one might worry about South Korea and Japan. If both South Korea and Japan were to go nuclear, one might worry about Taiwan, which had a secret nuclear weapons program in the past that it abandoned. If Iran becomes a heavily armed nuclear state, one might worry about other states in the Middle East. Turkey would be one obvious possibility. Egypt has had a secret nuclear weapons program in the past, might feel pressure. Saudi Arabia is suspected by some of having had interconnections with Pakistan's nuclear weapons program and links to the AQ Khan network. There's relatively little proof in the public domain about that, but nonetheless, they might come under pressure if Iran were to get nuclear weapons. Now, when I say come under pressure, I don't mean that I believe in any kind of a nuclear domino theory. What I mean is that it will affect calculations, it will affect incentives in different countries, and that we're going to have to take agile diplomatic action to put some incentives and in the other direction to help convince these various countries to stay non-nuclear should their neighborhoods become nuclearized. Hmm.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Dr. Matthew Bunn. He is a senior research associate in the Project for Managing the Atom. That's at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And we're talking about the issue of nuclear proliferation, or non-proliferation, if you will, the effort to try to prevent the spread of further spread of nuclear weapons around the world. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As you say, that the international efforts have been, one might say, have been quite successful, at least if we look at the number of nuclear states today and go back several decades. It really hasn't changed. And so we can talk about the systems that we have in place there being effective. There has perhaps been one, as far as we know, spectacular breakdown of the system, and that was the case of AQ Khan, the man who was acknowledged to be the father of the Pakistan nuclear weapon. He's a Pakistani scientist who was peddling nuclear expertise elsewhere outside of Pakistan. What was the problem there? What was the hole in the system that he managed to exploit?
Unfortunately, the AQ Khan case shows up multiple holes in the system. First of all, within Pakistan, there are two scenarios. Either the Pakistani government knew about and supported these exports, or they didn't. It's hard to say which of those is a more frightening scenario. If they didn't know about it, then this represents an amazing breakdown of security and control in a nuclear armed state over a very long period of time. We have to remember the AQ Khan network was operating on every inhabited continent over in more than 20 countries over a period of 20 years or more before it was finally taken down. And that represents failures in intelligence, failures in export control, failures in policy as well on the part of countries around the world, including the United States. There's a good deal that U.S. intelligence knew much earlier than when the network was finally stopped, and much of the damage that the network did, most of the damage that the network did, occurred after we knew something about what was happening and were watching to try to collect more information rather than stepping in immediately. And that was a judgment that was made at the time. I personally think an incorrect judgment, that we should have moved sooner than we did and stopped some of the worst damage that did take place. But the reality is today that some of these centrifuge design documents, centrifuge manufacturing manuals that the network was selling probably exist on discs in the hands of as yet unidentified middlemen and are probably going to get sold to additional countries in the future. Now, what we can do still is make sure we ratchet back as much as we can on the availability of some of these key technologies that are difficult to manufacture, some of these key parts of a centrifuge. One of the things the IAEA is doing now, for example, is really trying to talk to the companies that have the technology for some of these very critical and difficult to make parts. So there's only a few companies in the world that really have the ability to make them, and say, you know, whenever you get a query from somebody, if it looks weird and you normally wouldn't pursue it and you just throw it in the trash can, send it to us. And that way the IAEA is keeping track of a lot of the ongoing purchase attempts that are still being made by people and entities that are sort of left over from the CON network.
Mm-hmm. Just one further question, and I have some callers here I'll get to. If I think one could imagine that if you wanted to get your hands on a nuclear weapon, that it would be more direct, in a sense, to eliminate the middleman, and rather than try to build your own, see if you could buy an existing weapon. And here is where we get to concerns about security of existing nuclear stockpiles, and I suppose the main point of concern for a lot of people for some time now has been Russia, and people asking questions about how well secured are existing weapons. And here we get into concerns about non-state actors,
right,
who might, given sufficient funds, be able to purchase,
right,
an already existing weapon. How great a concern is that?
Unfortunately, I think that nuclear terrorism is a very real danger. It's not just a problem of actual assembled weapons. It's also, unfortunately, government study after government study has concluded that a reasonably sophisticated terrorist group, if it got nuclear material needed to make a bomb, either highly enriched uranium or plutonium, might well be able to put together at least a crude nuclear bomb. We know, because they've told us so and because of a variety of evidence that's been seized over the years, that Al-Qaeda has been attempting to get nuclear weapons for over a decade. The Japanese death terror cult Aum Shinrikyo that launched the nerve gas attack in the Tokyo subways also attempted to get nuclear weapons. And unfortunately, theft of the essential ingredients of nuclear weapons is not just a hypothetical worry. It's an ongoing reality. The International Atomic Energy Agency has documented some 18 cases of seizure of either highly enriched uranium or separated plutonium. So this is an ongoing problem. There are programs in place to try to reduce this danger by better locking up these stockpiles. We can talk more about them. They've made significant progress. The situation in Russia in particular is a lot better than it was 15 years ago, but there's a long, long way to go. Our programs still have a major gap between the urgency of this threat and the scale and pace of what we're doing to reduce it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some of the people that we have listening. Champaign County, we'll start it off here. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. A lot of things. I wanted you to talk about the idea of just de-emphasizing nuclear power, commercial nuclear power. This, of course, brings up the deal with India, which is a flagrant violation of NPT by the U.S., but you did point at the things that the U.S. could do to be less threatening with nuclear, change the nuclear. I think some of the things you might suggest are changing the nuclear posture review, and which calls for the use, and then to get our candidates on the Democratic side to stop saying that nuclear weapons are on the table, even to attack a non-state actor in a third country, such as what Hillary Clinton said, and all of that. So I think the U.S. Still funding Operation Stockpile and a useful nuclear weapon that I forget what the acronym for that is, but I think that's extremely important and hasn't been pointed at yet. So I'd like for you to elaborate.
All right.
Well, I think you're right that what the United States and the other nuclear weapon states do with their nuclear stockpiles has a huge impact on our ability to get political support from other countries for the steps that are needed to strengthen the global nonproliferation regime. Everything that needs to be done in the way of tougher export controls, more inspections, better enforcement, beefed up security for these nuclear stockpiles is going to mean more inconveniences and constraints on the non-nuclear weapon states. And if we want them to vote for those things, we have to make clear that we're willing to hold up our end of the bargain and accept some inconveniences and constraints ourselves. The reality is that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is the foundation of the whole global effort, legally binds the United States and the other nuclear weapon states to negotiate in good faith toward nuclear disarmament. And we have not been negotiating on any further arms reductions for some years now. And the non-nuclear weapon states overwhelmingly feel that we are not holding up our end of the bargain. And as long as that continues to be true, we're going to have great difficulty stopping the spread of nuclear weapons and putting in place the stronger measures that are needed now to get that job done.
I'll just go back here to the call. Did you want to follow up?
Well, yeah, I think the tone is doesn't actually acknowledge the amount of danger that's involved. And, you know, the U.S. using a nuclear weapon, as has been pointed out on NPR recently, isn't just, exploding the bomb. It's the threat. It's the... and the fact that the U.S. is still using it in this way is pernicious, and not just in the sense of threatening, you know, ability to negotiate. It's a threat to the world's existence, it seems to me, and I don't think that's overblown. I assume there's some other people waiting. Thank you.
Well, I think the caller is absolutely right that. What's important is not only how many nuclear weapons there are in our stockpile or what kind of nuclear weapons, but how we behave with our nuclear weapons and with our other power. I think that the way the United States has been behaving in recent times, and in particular holding open options for using nuclear weapons in a wide variety of cases other than just deterring the attack on us by other nuclear armed states, is very troubling and definitely undermines our ability to stem the spread of nuclear weapons to others. We have to move more rapidly toward putting nuclear weapons into the background of international affairs, making them something that, you know, only the few people who maintain them ever really have to think about.
Let's talk with someone in Belgium, the community not far from here, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Well, your previous caller and you all have been getting right at the point that I'd like to be a bit contrarian about. And what has it been, 62 years this month ago that we actually used them against another group of people? And that use has led us clear to this discussion today. And what I'm getting at is people who live through this are now becoming fewer and fewer. And they don't really realize the horrendous aspect of it. But yet, nothing works better than a very good demonstration. And you wonder, could that be part of the possible scenario, too? Maybe people who we can't deal with, i.e. terrorists who could use this, need to be demonstrated the horrendous aspect of this endeavor, if you see what I'm saying. So every now and again, once every few generations, maybe we should do something that show the horrid power of these things. Maybe not using them against another people, but setting one off out in space someplace and seeing just how powerful that thing is.
I'm reminded Ambassador Gerard Smith, who was one of the first arms reduction negotiators for the United States, sometimes worried that we made a mistake in ending all atmospheric nuclear testing, because he felt that there were getting to be fewer and fewer policymakers who had ever seen just how fearsome a nuclear blast actually is. And he actually suggested that perhaps once every 10 or 15 years the nations of the world ought to get together and set one off somewhere in some isolated location and invite a lot of the world's political leaders just to see just how horrifying the power of a nuclear bomb is. The listeners should remember that here we are, more than 15 years after the end of the Cold War, there are still more than 20,000 nuclear bombs in the world, and each one of those bombs is far larger than the bomb that obliterated the Japanese city of Hiroshima at the end of World War II. And I think the caller's right. People are forgetting just how awful nuclear weapons really are. There's a new film that's just out, White Rain, which I haven't seen yet, but I gather provides a very compelling account of just how horrifying the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were. There's a very troubling film. It's simply called Hiroshima Nagasaki, August 1945, and it's just footage that was taken both by Japanese and by Americans once American troops had reached the area after those atomic bombings. That I think more people should see this kind of footage and should really understand and feel the immense horror that is contained in nuclear weapons.
I agree, sir, but for some reason films just don't have the dramatic effect of an actual situation as you were describing by this ambassador. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Other questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. I'll just reintroduce our guest in just a moment, but I do want to pass a little bit of weather information on to you. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of northern Illinois that will be in effect until 1 this afternoon. And in our immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, this severe thunderstorm watch includes Livingston and McLean counties. So if you're living in that part of the state, you might just be aware that there's possibility of severe weather in your area this morning and this afternoon. And if we have more of these kinds of watches, we'll pass them on to you. I think we're expecting that there's the possibility of some severe weather here in a lot of our listening area over the next couple of days. And we'll have our next lengthy, more detailed report of the weather coming up as part of the afternoon magazine later today. Our guest, Matthew Bunn, is a senior research associate in the Project on Managing the Atom in the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And in his research, he's interested in the problems of nuclear theft and terrorism, also nuclear proliferation. Before joining the Kennedy School in 1997, he served 3 years as an advisor to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, where he played a major role in U.S. policies related to the control and disposition of weapons-usable nuclear materials, both in the United States and in the former Soviet Union. And we're talking about the problem of proliferation, nuclear, the spread of nuclear weapons. If you have questions, certainly you are welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we might return to the subject of the security of the stockpiles of not just weapons, but also of weapons, fissile material, the kind of stuff that you need to make a weapon. And as you said, there's concern that it is possible that if a terrorist group, for example, could get their hands on some of this material, it would be possible to build some kind of weapon from that. And I think that you said that the situation, particularly in Russia, is better than it was, but we still have some way to go to make sure that this material is secure. Can you talk more about that?
Well, that's right. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the security system for nuclear weapons and materials, much of it collapsed with it because it was based on a world that no longer existed. It was based on a world of a closed society, closed borders, pampered, well-cared-for nuclear workers who were getting the best of everything the Soviet Union had to offer, and everyone under close surveillance by the KGB. And essentially, all of that went away. And so many sites in the former Soviet Union had gaping holes in their fences, had literally no security camera at all in the area where the nuclear material was stored, had no detector at the door that would set off an alarm if someone was carrying plutonium out in their briefcase. Now, those really egregious problems have largely been fixed. You don't have sites anymore with gaping holes in their fences and that kind of thing. And as a result, the kind of threats that succeeded in stealing nuclear material in the 1990s, in one case, for example, literally one guy walking through a gaping hole in the fence, going up to what you and I would consider a tool shed, snapping the padlock on the tool shed, putting highly enriched uranium in his backpack and retracing his steps with nobody noticing until hours later. I'm reasonably confident there's no facility in the former Soviet Union where that could happen anymore. The reason to still be worried is that there are more substantial threats, both insider and outsider. We've seen massive corruption in Russia and the other states of the former Soviet Union that creates dangerous possibilities for insider theft. And in fact, there have been insider theft of practically everything that's not nailed down in Russia, including major conventional armaments stolen by military troops and so on. And then the outsider possibilities. I mean, this is a country where you have repeated incidents of 30, 40 heavily armed terrorists showing up with no warning, and it's the only country in the world where senior officials have confirmed that terrorist teams have been carrying out reconnaissance at secret nuclear weapon storage locations. So it remains a worrisome situation. But you have to remember, this is not a Russia problem, it's a global problem. The essential ingredients of nuclear weapons exist in more than 40 countries around the world, and the security for those stockpiles ranges from excellent to appalling. There are no binding global standards in place for how secure nuclear weapons or nuclear materials should be. The biggest risks of theft, in my view, are Russia, because it has the world's largest stockpiles and the world's largest number of buildings and bunkers, security that's improved from, I would say, poor to medium, and huge threats from very active terrorists in the country, insider threats as well. Secondly, Pakistan, relatively small nuclear stockpile, thought to be heavily guarded, but immense threats. You know, this is where the central command of al-Qaeda is reconstituting. They have major jihadi terrorist groups operating in the country with links into sympathetic people in the government and the nuclear establishment, and big insider threats. From the AQ Khan network, we know that at least some Pakistani nuclear insiders are willing to sell practically anything to practically anyone. Third, I would identify as civilian research reactors that are fueled with highly enriched uranium. These are reactors, some of them on university campuses, many of them with very little security in place, and yet using highly enriched uranium, which is one of the easiest materials in the world to make a nuclear bomb from. Many of them don't have much highly enriched uranium on site, but a surprising number of them do. And so we need to move very quickly to get that highly enriched uranium out of those places and to lock the remaining sites down as firmly as we possibly can. We need a major increase in the level of sustained high-level leadership to overcome the obstacles to getting these stockpiles locked down.
All right. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. The next is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah. Just three, three areas, and you can comment on, which ones you'd like to. The first one has to do with the U.S. development of small nuclear weapons, this interest in space, and also, the past development, the Star Wars thing, and also, now we have sort of a derivative of it. But what's your feeling about these areas?
Well, by the small nuclear weapons, you're probably referring to the small-scale, what were called bunker busters, that were proposed early in the Bush administration. Congress, I think, correctly put its foot down and said, no, the United States should not be developing new nuclear weapons capabilities, and particularly not new ones designed to be more, quote, usable, unquote, than the previous nuclear weapons. Now, the reality is, however, that the existing U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile already has nuclear weapons whose yield can be adjusted, and whose yield can be adjusted down to very, very low yields. So if there were a future circumstance where the U.S. president was seriously considering the use of a nuclear weapon and wanted to make it as small a nuclear weapon as possible, that kind of capability already exists, for better or for worse, in the U.S. Nuclear weapon stockpile. In terms of space weapons, missile defense, there isn't any current plan to put actual nuclear weapons in space. There are a variety of current research and development efforts related to conventional weapons that might be able to shoot down satellites, or maybe even putting some conventional weapons into space to attack other satellites, or conceivably at some point in the future to attack targets on the ground. I think all of those are likely to bring us more danger than security and are probably unwise, and that we ought to reconsider the U.S. opposition to negotiating more constraints on the testing and deployment of any satellite capabilities.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Let's go to Urbana, the next caller. Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, I've read recently that we have 10,000 nuclear weapons in the United States and Russia has 10,000 to 15,000. Seems to me those are wildly excessive numbers. If we battled everybody that is our supposed enemy in the world and had a lot of our nuclear weapons knocked out in a preemptory strike by the other side, then we would still have 1,000 nuclear weapons. Would you comment on the just the sheer number relative to the mission?
Yes, I think the possession of many thousands of nuclear weapons was insane during the Cold War, and 15 years after the Cold War is over, it's insane squared. These huge stockpiles pose far more danger to us than they provide security to us, and we should be moving very rapidly to far deeper reductions, not just in the weapons deployed on the tips of strategic ballistic missiles that have been limited by the arms control agreements in recent times, but to get rid of, to limit the total stockpiles of nuclear weapons. There's really no plausible reason why either the United States or Russia needs more than 1,000 nuclear weapons, and many people would argue that is too many. If memory serves, in some polls I saw a few years ago, when you asked people how many nuclear weapons they thought the United States had right now, the median answer was about 200. So they were, you know, wildly off as to how many we have. The correct number is about 10,000. And they also, in that poll, thought that that was probably too many. And I think the American people are roughly right on that, that if 200 was in our stockpile, there would probably still be some room for reduction.
Well, this I appreciate the caller raising the question because it was something that I wanted to come back to. And I think it's certainly, again, worth making the point that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was, in a sense, a kind of bargain between the states that had the weapons and the states that didn't. And the states that didn't on their side were saying, we promise by signing that we will not develop these weapons, but the states that already had them were signing and supposed to be promising that they would move towards reducing the number of weapons that they had. And there, again, as you say, I think it's the United States and Russia, perhaps the other countries can be, although those are the two that have the most, can be criticized for not doing enough to fulfill their part of the bargain, that is to reduce their nuclear arsenals. And I think it's true that in the past, at least since the end of the Cold War, there have been times when we actually have been making an effort in that direction, although it has slowed. Where does that effort stand now? What sort of resources are we putting into that, particularly in trying to assist Russia in decommissioning existing weapons?
Well, that has been a substantial effort over the 15-plus years since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and there are many hundreds of nuclear ballistic missiles that have been taken apart, and their missile silos destroyed, the submarines cut up, and so on. There are thousands of nuclear weapons that used to be deployed and pointed at the United States that are no longer have any missile or anything to carry them. One thing many people don't realize is that we haven't actually provided any direct assistance to Russia in dismantling the actual nuclear weapons, because in order to spend the U.S. taxpayers' money on that, you'd want to be able to verify that it was actually being done, and the verification measures so far have proved too sensitive to move forward with. What we have done, and many people don't realize this, launched a huge commercial deal in which the United States buys low-enriched uranium for its nuclear power plants that's blended from Russian highly enriched uranium from dismantled nuclear bombs. And that, you know, destroys uranium that could otherwise potentially get stolen and be used in a nuclear bomb, or if circumstances change, be put back into Russia's nuclear bombs. And it gives Russia a financial incentive to dismantle thousands of nuclear weapons, and it provides us nuclear fuel at a reasonable price. And today, almost half of all the nuclear energy generated in the United States is actually coming from dismantled Russian nuclear bombs. It's about one in every 10 light bulbs in the United States is being lit by nuclear material from dismantled nuclear bombs. It's really quite a remarkable phenomenon.
Just quickly introducing again our guest, Matthew Bunn. He's a senior research associate in the Project on Managing the Atom. That's a part of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. We're talking about the spread of nuclear weapons, or the effort to limit the spread of nuclear weapons. And we have maybe about 5 minutes left. If someone wants to call and get in on the conversation, they certainly may. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to get back to a point that was mentioned by an earlier caller, and that is the fact that if you have a nuclear reactor that you use to generate energy, and a lot of nations do, then you're going to have a byproduct that can be processed into a weapons-grade material. So here we have the problem of if you have nuclear power plants, then at least there's the potential to take the material and to develop nuclear weapons. Is there some way to decouple those two things and so make it possible for a nation, if they choose, that's using nuclear power as an energy source to do what we can so that then that material then doesn't end up going on it and being processed and developed so that it could be used in a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, I think there's an immense amount we can do to weaken that linkage and reduce that risk. You can never eliminate that linkage because, you know, there aren't two atoms, one military and one civilian. There's one atom. But just as an example of the kinds of things that can be done, the United States and a number of other countries around the world are now working on reactors that would be small and would have what's called a sealed core, so the fuel would be in this sort of sealed capsule, and they would be built in a factory and then shipped to a particular country that was going to use this, and they would sit there for maybe 15 years and generate electricity with no refueling, no access by that country to that material, and then be shipped back to the factory where they were made. And by that kind of approach, you might very well be able to have a large-scale use of nuclear energy to try to cope with climate change without having much impact on the risk of nuclear proliferation.
We have another caller. Let's talk with him. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Very, very important issue. A recent book called The Atomic Bazaar, I'm not sure of the author's name now, it's pretty long, was about the Khan network from Pakistan,
yeah,
and how he would, through sub companies or front companies, would buy all these extremely complex centrifuges and all this material and these chemicals and stuff. And after reading the book, you just throw your arms up there and say, well, if you've got companies selling stuff that they know have second and dual use, then this guy could do this under the aegis of the Pakistani government. I guess now he's in house arrest. And also, just look at the thousands and thousands of warheads. I mean, I'm sort of a pessimist about this. I agree that you have to do something, and doing something is better than doing nothing. But it's just amazing to me how this stuff is built up over the years, and everybody just sort of looks at it like, Well, but the Khan network, of course, is what the book's about. It's amazing how he could do all this stuff, and everybody sort of turned the other way. They figured, what the hell, right? And then you find out when Libya decided to, or, you know, Gaddafi said, well, hell, I'm going to get out of this mess, and he just gives everybody all this stuff. I have this, this, and this, and then you see Iran buying these centrifuges on the black market. I mean, what are your issues? I mean, do you deal with these issues in your work? I'd like to know that. Could you comment on that, please?
Yes, and in fact, listeners may be interested. I have a review of that book that just came out in American Scientist, which is available on the web.
Oh, okay, thanks.
I think, frankly, that I have major problems with the book because of the overwhelming pessimism that Langewisha puts forward. His basic argument is that proliferation is inevitable, and we just have to learn to live with it. And I think that if policymakers come to believe that, they will fail to take the actions that we can and should take now to reduce the risk of nuclear proliferation. But anyway, I will leave that to the review. With respect to the Khan network, it was a giant proliferation disaster. There's no doubt about it. But if you draw back for a moment, you say, now, wait a minute. They were marketing centrifuge technologies for 20 years to some of the most determined and hostile regimes on the planet. And none of those regimes, in fact, ended up with a nuclear weapon as a result of it. North Korea got a nuclear weapon from plutonium that it was doing long before it had any encounters with Khan, and they never managed to get the HEU enrichment to work. Iran has got a bunch of centrifuges up and running now, but they still haven't managed to get them running the way they want them to run, and they haven't started producing any HEU. Libya abandoned its program, as you mentioned. Iraq had an offer from the AQ Khan network just before the 1991 war, but fortunately the 1991 war intervened before they had a chance to take them up on it. So we had this giant proliferation disaster, which represented gaping holes in the world export control and intelligence effort, but nonetheless managed by luck and various other means to avoid having it lead to additional nuclear weapon states. So I think it tells you something about what needs to be fixed in the global regime in the way of stronger export controls, better intelligence, more international cooperation, and the like. But it also tells you that it's not that easy to get nuclear weapons, and that even with determined states, it takes a long time, and there's time for the international community to act.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with you. I agree with the pessimism of the book, and I only thing I would recommend people do is read the first chapter, which explains a nuclear explosion, the temperature, the amount of energy that's released during these things, and it's sort of forgotten because everybody, 60 years ago or whatever, they ended above the ground testing, and they haven't tested weapons for a long time. Well, the Koreans, North Koreans, had a failure. And I agree with you. I'm pessimistic only because when I read that, I think, what are these companies doing? I mean, the networks go after the holes in the countries. What do you call their intelligence estimates or their their trade laws or trade rules? And I'm just wondering. I think your work's very important, and I'm glad you're on. And I do think that the other book is worth reading because of just the sheer, oh, my God, what the hell's going to happen thing. But thank you. I really appreciate your work. It's really important. Thank
well,
you. Well,
I also think that a lot of companies have been shocked by the kinds of things that they have seen their own products end up in. And one of the most hopeful presentations I've heard in a long time was a presentation a couple of months ago by one of the key companies that manufactures centrifuge-related technologies in Germany about the internal process that it has established for vetting any export that might be even a little bit sensitive. They were one of the companies that were embarrassed when they found huge things that they had made in the middle of Iraqi nuclear plants after the 1991 war. And they've had this mechanism in place for quite some time now, and it's working remarkably well, and I think could be a model for other companies. Among other things, one of the distressing aspects, although people say the AQ Khan network has been taken down, they estimated that there were over €20 million in business that they had turned down over the past few years, and in 2005, I think it was, they just stopped counting because there was so much money that they had been offered for different things that they knew they shouldn't fulfill those orders.
Yeah, we're at the point essentially we have to stop. I was going to ask a question, and I'm thinking I wouldn't really be able to give you enough time to answer it. So perhaps we'll just leave it there, with the promise that this is an issue that we'd like to touch on from time to time, and I'm sure in future we'll be coming back to as a way of updating it. But for the moment, we would say thanks to our guest, Dr. Matthew Bunn. He is Senior Research Associate in the Project on Managing the Atom in the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And Dr. Bunn, thank you very much.
Thank you. And if anyone is interested in following up, they can go to our webpage at managingtheatom.org, where almost all of our publications are available in full text.
Very good. Again, thanks. We appreciate your time.
Pleasure to be here.